welcome back to another episode of the Millsap World Podcast. We are joined today by our Patreon guest, Jared, a.k.a. Billy. I haven't decided what I want to call you yet.
Either's okay.
And, of course, we have Aaron here with us today as well.
Hi.
Well, I guess we'll start off just with introducing you, Jared, and I think it was the questions we ask everyone. How'd you get into Millsaps? Any recent acquisitions? And tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I've been interested in Millsaps. I remember watching Tales of the Gun as a younger adult. So I remember like wanting them. And then when I was old enough to buy them, I did. My first one I ever bought was the usual 9130. That I got for, I think, $88.
Yeah.
I still have it. I have four of them now. I think I recently bought a Venezuelan FN-49. Is my most.
Ooh, that's nice. I'm actually watching one on GunBroker right now. Just, it's tempting me.
I was able to get this one for, it's missing the muzzle brake, but I was able to get it for $1,000. So I thought I did pretty good.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Yeah. It's a pretty good price.
And then,
are those 7mm?
Have you shot it?
They are 7mm, and no, I have not shot it.
But yes, in God's own caliber. So, like a semi automatic in 7mm Mauser, that's just, that's really swell. It's like the main reason why I want to get one. Like, I don't want any other country really of FN-49, just the Venezuelan one for 7mm.
Mm hmm. The other thing I do a lot of is I do a lot of reloading for obsolete calibers. So I haven't shot I have a 7184 Mauser, Martini Henry, and a Snyder 577. So
nice,
some big boy black powders.
Yeah, I do enjoy the large bore black powder stuff as well.
Have you seen the video where we show my Mannlicher 1886?
Yes, and I covet that rifle, and I'm jealous that you have one.
Did you hear the reason how I got it?
Yeah.
For those that don't know, it was incorrectly listed on GunBroker, and the gentleman put it up as and if you're unaware, just like eBay, they have, you can set it so you can do buy it now. The gentleman had set it for a buy it now of $300. That was his mistake.
I was actually able to purchase a Berdan number 2. That was listed as a Mauser 71 for $800 because of that.
Mike, that's nice. Mike's always wanted one of those, hasn't he? Danny, I think Mike's.
Yeah, Berdans are pretty cool.
Yeah. There was a Berdan 2 here for sale locally for a while.
Yeah, I ran into a Berdan 2 local to me also one time, just in a random shop. I can't remember how much they wanted, but I think it was like $1,500 or something out of my price range.
Yeah, mine come from Alaska from GunBroker, and it was $800 shipped.
Man, Alaska.
That's cool. That's the way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if it actually came over from Russia.
There's no import marks on it that I can find. Just and I've had the action out of the stock.
They just walked it over.
Yeah, across the Bering Strait.
I guarantee those guys that up there, that were stationed anywhere near that part of Russia did not have the latest firearms.
Yeah, I would think they probably had worse than that, if possible.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there is like some sort of embargo against, I think, Russian guns or something like that. But being antique, I bet it wouldn't be super hard to get into the country.
No, I believe you can ship antiques. I'm not sure on that, but I believe you can, because most people who say they like antiques is because you can ship them.
Well, it's cool that you still have your first Millsap. I still have the first Millsap I ever bought as well.
Same here.
I think it's a good one to keep.
Yeah, it's like a minute of pie plate shooting it. But I'm not getting rid of it because it's the first one I ever bought.
Yeah. Well, today, topic is going to be just on the current Millsap market. So this is going to kind of be the 2020 podcast on the Millsap market. We did one back in 2019, and I'm glad we didn't do one earlier in the year. The Millsap market just a few months ago to today is completely different. There's no telling how much it's going to change over the next few months. Of course, with the current pandemic happening, there's all sorts of weird things going on.
Yeah. That's for sure.
Yeah, I've noticed some weird trends in selling, too, because of it. Like, some of the cheaper guns maybe have been getting sold because of the newer people buying them. Things like the, what is it, the Yugo M57s and things like that.
Yeah, there's been some real oddities going on right now. I guess the comments on my on the video that I did on the COVID-19, the guy talked about that as a sort of a follow-up. He just commented that the market really has softened up just over the past, you know, few weeks or whenever it was that I posted that video, because it's prices are going down for sure, which is, you know, it's obvious right now. You have a, I think last I heard it was like 22 million, you know, people that filed for unemployment in the last 28 days. So you have a lot of people that get, you know, they're fired.
It's 32 million now total.
Yeah. Yeah. That's just insane. So you're going to have a lot of people that are going to not be buying mil SERPs. Some people, it doesn't matter. And they're still going to be buying really cool, old and or expensive mil SERPs. Regardless of that, at least for the short term. So
yeah, I don't know.
We're gonna have to bring that up sometime here.
I don't see this affecting the high end market a whole lot. It usually doesn't.
I have seen a couple of the high end guns be at lower prices though, like a G24Ts and 9840s actually have seemed to come down a few hundred bucks.
The difference is going to be for those is that you're going to see stuff that's high end but doesn't have a huge following is going to probably start to come down. But I'm going to say, I'll just put out my prediction, Danny. I'll just do that. Anything with a common caliber, I don't think we'll see a big drop on. Maybe a little bit. It's going to soften. But I don't see like anything 8mm. I don't see anything like 7.62x51. I don't see those guys dropping too much. What do you think?
Yeah, anything you can buy ammo for in the store, I could understand that, because usually it seems the ammo that goes away fast, it's always like 8mm and 7.62x54 is left in the stores.
Yeah, I think we'll see a softening of the stuff that's more difficult to make. I think Japanese firearms are going to soften when they were just starting to actually start to get a little bit more expensive.
Yeah, I do think some of the higher end items that are really sought after by some of the, you know, by collectors, like maybe, you know, like older people that have a lot of savings and, you know, it doesn't really matter so much to them. You know, they're still probably going to be, you know, buying these certain rare guns, but kind of have a feeling that just overall with less buyers on the market, I think this is, you can mostly see this like on Gun Broker, like the auction sites. Just going to have less people bidding, and less people bidding is, you know, it's just going to leave the price, you know, ending quite a bit lower. And then you're going to have, you know, a lot of people selling guns too. So that's the flip side of it.
I think we'll see a lot of inventory come in from the casual collectors.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yeah, the casual collector.
I don't think we'll see a lot of big inventories unless this gets really bad. We're talking like a couple hundred thousand people die from this pandemic. But I think that I think the casual collector market is definitely going to suffer.
You might see some people too moving some things that they don't really care about as much. You know, maybe I've had X rifle for a while and I don't shoot it, so I might move it to make some more money, you know, because my funding is less as well.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
I do a lot of, like, if I have a lot of guns, I don't sell a lot of guns, but I know, okay, if I need money, I can sell a Yugo M48 because I don't care, because I have German rifles, or, you know, just as an example. So,
yeah.
I would say call it like a narrowing your collection.
Yeah, or focusing. Both are very, yes. I would say the shops around here got less traffic as well, because at least where I'm at, you have to have an appointment to go in the shops. So you can't go to gun stores to buy guns unless you make an appointment, which is a pain. So not a lot of people, myself included, have been doing that.
Wow. Yeah. My FFL is like a individual that just runs it out of his residence. And what I picked up a batch of guns from him last week, week before, and he had a little table set up outside of his front door, and I didn't go inside like usual. He kind of stayed behind the door, like he had a glass, like a glass outer door, and kind of one of those weird things. It's never before would I have thought that it'd make a fell transfer real weird like that. And I forgot the other day, about a week ago, actually I went to like a gun and pawn store. I was riding, I have an e-bike, and I was riding my e-bike about 10 miles from my house. There was this this shop, and I was like, oh, pawn a gun, cool, I'll go in. And just told the guy he was into old stuff, and he's like, oh, sorry, usually, you know, we carry a lot of guns, but we're sold out right now.
Yeah, the business is booming for sure.
Yeah. So it's a really odd thing, because like, shops are sold out of guns, but it seems like it's a lot of the newer commercial guns, self-defense oriented type of guns. I think those are selling. I think the, you know, milsurps that are kind of like, you know, maybe less, to use a current buzzword, there it's less essential, or it's a non-essential, you know, firearm. I think milsurps are, you know, people are just going to be like, oh, I don't want that old gun right now. I need to buy a new handgun to, you know, to myself with or whatever. So it might be a good time to maybe work some trade deals with people who, you know, if they have old guns and you have new guns and, you know, you guys want to trade, it might be a good time to do that. It's really odd that we can see old milsurps going for less money, but gun stores are sold out or have almost sold out.
It's almost like the recent scares that have happened over the last 10 years or so. You would expect the prices to increase, but it's actually depressed the value so much because the economy has been hit so hard.
Yeah. It's been a weird couple of things, because we've seen scares. Well, first off, this is an all-time high gun sale period. Like, there's been no other time in American history where they've sold more guns. And, you know, than the past, you know, month. And
Danny, it cut off.
Okay, you hear me?
I hear you now. You said you just said that you they had sold no more time in American history that they sold more guns, and then it cut off.
Yeah, no more time that they sold like more guns than right now. But there's a large amount of them coming onto the market of these old variants. And because of also in the past with these certain scares and these certain, you know, large volume scares, like maybe when Obama got elected or reelected, or after a mass shooting or something, when, you know, when typical guns sell out, gun prices kind of go up because everyone's wanting to buy them. There was no real economic hit back then. So, you know, maybe a little bit in like 2008, if you guys remember what the milsurp market was like back then. But this is unique. This is a really unique time to be in the market, and it'll be real weird kind of seeing what's happening with, you know, with gun prices over the next couple of months.
Yeah, like the number of sales versus 2012, you couldn't buy an AR anywhere, but we have more sales now than we did then, which is just strange.
Yeah, I guess the good thing, this is a little bit out of our scope probably, but I think the good thing about this is we're getting like different sort of breed of people that are buying guns now. So the optimistic part of me is hoping that this is, you know, going to get people that never have thought that they would buy a gun before be into guns now. Maybe, you know, over the next couple of years or so, there's going to be people that maybe bought their first ever, you know, gun during the COVID scare. Then they found out, hey, I actually really like these, and oh, I like older guns too. And, you know, we could actually see, you know, a new generation of people that are into milsurps, you know, that got into specifically buying guns, you know, from COVID. So
I have seen
kind of an interesting possibility.
For those that I agree with you, Danny, I've seen quite a few. I'm on Reddit, and I've made a name for myself on the milsurp Reddit. For being the M95 guy. I wonder why.
You're like the only one?
No, there's like five of us. But I've seen quite a few posts in the past month or two, and on a couple of other firearm-related Reddits, that subreddits, that there's been quite a few people that have come in and gone, I've never bought a gun before, like, what should I do? I've never would have thought of buying a gun, but now I don't feel safe and I want to make sure. And it's a lot of, it's like you said, Danny, a lot of people that would have never considered buying one before, I think, are suddenly all of a sudden going, maybe I should.
Yeah. There's a lot of articles coming out about, you know, different police departments in the country that weren't going to respond to, you know, theft and, you know, certain petty crimes. So, which is probably the first time that's ever happened before that any of us can remember, you know, in our living memory. So it's a scary feeling for a lot of people that non-gun people always just assume, like, I don't need a gun, I can call 911. So now when the 911 kind of goes away, or at least feels like it's gonna go away, then the gun sounds like a really good backup.
Billy mentioned something earlier too that I've noticed too. A lot of people have been buying these M57s. Like Classic has had a bunch come in, and I guess some other importer had a bunch come in, and a lot of people have been buying these up.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of them, and a lot of the Romanian TTC, like the same thing.
Yeah.
AIM had them. AIM Surplus.
Oh yeah, okay.
You know, that would make sense for the average Joe. They just want a cheap handgun. Probably, I bet most people want, you know, a handgun, for whether or not it's the best is up for debate. But it's what most people probably want, a handgun for self defense, and you know, they don't know the difference between an old, you know, Takarev and a new whatever. So it's cheap.
I would not recommend a M57 for self defense.
No,
I mean, I got just a run of a mill one.
I would say over penetration much.
If you can get the surplus ammo to not split cases in it. I've had a lot of my, I have one of them and they've split a lot of cases. I picked up one of them in a deal with a Argentine Ballister Molina, and I was excited. I never shot one of these, and wicked fast round, but it split, I think, 6 out of 10 cases with surplus ammo. And it was Polish ammo. It wasn't like Chinese or, you know, lesser quality.
How was the Ballister?
The sights are terrible.
Yeah,
they're horrible. The bore on it was okay. It did pretty good. It did better than I thought it would, but the sights were very hard to read.
Yeah, I have those old style of sight video on Ballisters that kind of made me want to get a British one.
Yeah, they're that would be the one I would want to get, but I think I just got a good deal on it. I have a C&R license, so it's nice to be able to go into gun shows and be like, I'll take that, goodbye, and then hand them my license. So,
is a background check, mandatory background checks for private sales in PA?
Only for handguns, as far as I'm aware.
That's cool. Yeah. They just passed that, or at least in Tallahassee, where I went to the gun shows. But I live in Kansas City, Missouri now, and that's one of the nice things. I don't really have to worry about that when I'm in a Missouri gun show.
Yeah, rifles. I was able to get because I did this recently. I bought a No. 1 Mark III for like $400, and it's beautiful. But it was just give the guy the money and have a good day. But I know handguns for 100% certain, you have to have a background check or a C&R license works too.
Yeah. What do the dealers up there typically charge for a transfer?
I would say it's anywhere between the really weird one is that there's one gun store I go to that's $4, and then there's other gun stores that are like $50.
$4?
Yeah.
Never heard of that.
Yep. I bought a handgun at a it's actually an Ace Hardware that has a gun store attached to it. So they gave me my gun in an Ace Hardware bag.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
That's old school, because Ace used to sell guns. A lot of them actually used to.
It was really cool, and they don't take my C&R license, which is okay. It's their right. And they're like, okay, it's $4 for the transfer, $1 something for the tax, and then, you know, I'm like, oh, $4 isn't bad. I guess I'm not angry about that.
Wow.
That's what you get for having a transfer done by a large corporation. They're just going to eat that fee.
Does it even cost them anything?
I mean, they have to maintain the FFL.
There's one gun store that's really close to me that if I buy anything new, I deal with them because they deal specifically in internet transfers, and it's a really good deal. You get their a copy of their FFL right on the website, and you can forward it on to where it's going. And the rules are, they have two rules, which is don't call us and tell us you bought a gun. Just watch your tracking info and come in when it comes in. And then you have to take the box. And their transfer fee is $26.50 with tax. And they prefer to do those over have anything in the store because there's no overhead. It's free as long as they keep their license up to date.
Yeah. That's why a lot of them here in my area, they do like $20. They don't really do much else. They just do transfers. And they're like, they're not going to charge a bunch of money because they're just going to be like, whatever.
Yeah. Around here for like the FFLs that just sort of do it through their own residence, it seems like $20 is about the norm for most of them. In Florida, it was like anywhere between 10 and 20. But most shops around here, they charge like $40 to $50 for a transfer, which is just crazy. Like I would never even think about paying that.
Yeah. A lot of the shops here charge, some of them even do a percentage based on the item.
Oh, wow.
Oh, I hate that.
Yeah.
I heard of a couple that try to do that, like a percentage of what it's like, that makes no sense. Like what world does that make sense that you would charge that?
I don't know.
I've never heard of that before.
Yeah. It's mostly on new stuff in particular. So they know what the value of them are. So they like charge a percentage based on the value of the firearm, but it's just so stupid.
That's gross.
That's why I like having the license is if I deal with anybody who accepts it, they're always very happy because they don't really have to do any paperwork. They just fill out in their book that it went to me and I fill out in my book that I got it from them and we're done.
You know, Danny, that brings up a good point. We might see a surge in CNR license applications.
It's $30.
It's like 10 years, isn't it? Or 4 years?
What is it? No, I think it's like, I'd have to look at my, I think it's like 3 years or 4 years.
It's a weird number. I don't remember.
Yeah. But it's $30, so if you buy two guns, it pays for itself. And I think last year, I had to renew mine at the beginning of this year, and then make you count up how many guns you bought, and I bought like 25. So it paid for mine.
I've always been really on the fence on getting a CNR. Like, I like the idea of it a lot. I also hate some other ideas of it.
I like
Danny's the thinking they're going to break him in. They're going to break in his house, shoot his dog.
Well, they only know what you bought if they audit you. So the way that I understand it. So there's no, it's not like it's online where they can see, oh, you bought 30 guns. Like it's just, it's your own book and you're responsible for your own record keeping. But I love it because the FedEx guy shows up at my house with a big long box and he laughs every time. He's like, is this a gun? Yeah. He's like, cool. Okay, here you go. Sign here. And that's it. Or if you're not available to be home, you can set up for pickup at like a FedEx store or a UPS store or the post office, however the shipper decides to sell it. And it's so much nicer than having to go to a gun store that you know doesn't have anything, if you can even find one that'll let you buy from the internet, because out here that's very difficult.
It's here too. The first off, the stigmatism too, they would prefer you to buy from them. And then also just like, they don't like dealing with anything. The laws in Illinois being what they are as well, they don't like to deal with anything that they deem fishy.
Yeah, I will always keep my CNR because it is so nice to be able to just go down and see the guy and sign the thing, and then I get my gun and I get to play with it right then. Speaking along the lines of the COVID thing, though, I've the last time I got a rifle, which was the FN-49, the FedEx guy was training a new guy or UPS or whoever. And he's like, okay, normally this is what you would do. He gives me the box and he's like, okay, he's going to sign, but he's not because we're sick or everyone's sick. So he like fills out my name and then puts like COVID-19 or whatever next to it. They had a policy for actually signing for a package.
Oh
yeah. It was kind of weird.
Yeah. Especially for a firearms delivery.
Mm-hmm. Which they don't really know it's a firearm. I mean, mine came from a place that was clearly a firearm, but they also have like you need to be 21 to sign for this package. or eight, I believe it's 21.
Yeah,
and he like looks 21. At me, and I got a beard enough. He's like, he's 21, which I am. So,
yeah, that was a sad time for me when I stopped getting carded. But yeah, probably.
Well, Danny and I both see... had. I'm sorry. Go on, Danny. What, you're breaking up?
Mm-hmm. I could see like this COVID-19 thing with if they're gonna just sign for you and leave it there. I could see maybe some possible, gun thefts and stuff happening from guns being left on people's doorsteps or on even like FFLs that operates out of their homes, guns being stolen. That's a whole possibility.
I was just about to say, haven't we both experienced that, Danny, where people they've just signed for you and left it?
Yeah. Yeah. With, buying antiques. There's that one story. I already mentioned it.
And I bought an M57 and it was sitting on my porch.
I've had that too. I've actually had to, I have the ability to leave work if I need to, because I can work from home. And it was, I got to go. Why? Because this carrier signed for my package and it's a rifle. So it's sitting outside right now. And I only live like 12 minutes from work. So they were okay. So I was fortunate to be able to go home and just get it off the porch.
Cool. Your employer doesn't give you weird looks when you tell them you have to go get a gun?
I have a very weird working situation. they probably would, but we have the ability, as long as you're not doing something specifically, you can work from home and they actually encourage you to work from home. That way there's no like cost of travel and all that, so... and being so close, it was, I'm just going to take my lunch break now, run home and get this and come back kind of a thing.
That's cool. Yeah. I worked for a company for a short minute that was really weird about guns. I met this other really cool gun guy at work. It was kind of funny, like how we both found out that we were gun guys. Like it was talking, like we couldn't say like guns or arms or whatever. We had to use like coded language not to like alert anyone. That's cool that you could mention it.
I always thought my work isn't super gun friendly, but then I remembered I brought in a holster and left it on my desk all day and nobody said anything to me.
Is it like an old holster? Or...
Yeah, I bought a holster for the M57, but it was dried out. The leather was dried out. So I had a friend of mine that was going to recondition it, but she wasn't there that day. So I had to leave it on my desk. And nobody said a thing to me. Nobody was like, why is there a gun holster on your desk? What's going on? Is there a gun in that? Nobody said a damn thing.
Yeah. They probably didn't know.
Yeah, I bet that, yeah, old leather holsters, nobody.
It's a really weird cell phone case.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, in the age of cell phone cases, it's... Oh, man. Yeah, if people haven't guessed it, this is the whole episode of Digression. This is the episode of Digression.
Yeah.
I want any more people hating on Aaron for cracking a whip on us to keep us on track. So it's going to be all over the place.
Loosey goosey.
That mean 8mm guy.
What did I buy though, Danny? It's not 8mm.
Oh yeah. You want to talk about that now?
I don't really want to brag.
Okay. So you want me to brag for you?
Sure.
I'll brag for you. Right. So this gun is the gun that we just mentioned, I think, in the last podcast of Regrets, which is really interesting because I just recently bought a gun that I mentioned in one of my regrets. And then now you have.
Yay.
And that is the from the secret seller shall not be named. You got a rather swell the Navy bayonet. Oh, wow. And a clipazine for it,
and ammo,
and oh yeah, what did you get? Like five yeah, rounds of original ammo.
Clip, yeah.
It's original ammo though.
Yep.
Yeah, that's dude. Original 6mm Navy is pretty rare.
There's a guy selling it on GunBroker right now for $25 a round.
Yeah. So remember you were telling me about it. I wrote you like a list of reasons. Talk to your wife. Mention this. This is how you sell it.
It's weird to me. It's still weird to me. It's something I've always wanted. Something that even before I really collected firearms, that I remember looking up and for some reason found it. And I was like, oh, that'd be cool to have. And I just like, oh, I'll never see one. They're so rare. But then, and we've talked about this before, is like, for some reason, even though as rare as they are and as old as they are, they're not that expensive compared to something else in the same category, I would think.
Yeah, it's one of those weird guns where it rarely comes up for sale, especially like in that sort of condition. It doesn't sell for as high as you think it would based on its rarity.
I can't believe you found one. That's awesome. I would really enjoy having one like that.
Yeah, I'm very lucky. This gentleman that I bought it from, he is, I would say, probably one of the, if not the top premier Mannlicher and straight pull collector in the United States. And I don't know if he's just loosening his inventory or if he's just trying to get out of it or something. I don't know what's happening, but he's got so much nice stuff. Danny's our friend Gage has bought so many things from him too.
Yeah. He refuses to talk to me though.
He's very paranoid, Danny.
I don't know why I'm throwing a flag for this guy. I guess I'm just that intimidating.
I don't know. He's an older gentleman and he's very paranoid.
Have you ever talked to him about me?
Yes, I have. I told him you were okay.
And he like watched me on YouTube and stuff, and he's still like, I don't trust that guy.
Maybe you're too much celebrity.
I can't explain his actions. I know.
I would say I've been looking for wedge lockers for a while, and I haven't been able to really see any for sale that were even close to like a price range I would think they would be. Usually they're very rusted and beat up. Either the 8890 or the 86.
Yeah, I got super lucky on the one I got. I wasn't even looking to buy one. I was looking for an 8890, and that's what it was listed as. And I wasn't paying attention. And when I showed it to another friend of mine who's big into that era, because I'm not big into the black powder big bore as much as I am the other ones. He's like, that's not an 8890, that's an 86. And I was like,
I've recently been getting the wife into the larger bore black powder smoke guns just for the enjoyment of it. I like the, you load one round, you shoot one round. It just seems to bring a lot of attention at the range. People usually look over like, what are you doing and what is that? And I kind of enjoy bringing the weirdest thing I can to the range.
I know that feeling. When I had a PSL, that always got everybody going, what the heck are you doing? I never really cared for the PSL, but it definitely was an attention getter.
Mm-hmm.
That's a weird looking AK.
Yeah, that's actually and to be fair to the people that don't really know, it really is basically just a big AK.
Yeah, it's not like an SVT. It's actually an AK platform, isn't it?
Yeah, it's based off the RPK, which is based off the AK. So, I mean, it's literally just a stretched out AK. So it's to say like, oh, that's a weird looking AK, that's not a wrong thing to say.
A friend of mine bought one of those and he likes the hyper accurate rifles and handguns, and he did not like it at all. It did not perform the way he expected it to.
It's not a sniper rifle.
No, and I tried to kind of explain that a little bit. I knew that it was more of like a DMR kind of Minuteman at 300 kind of a thing, and
yeah,
he shot it and the scope fell off of it, which just made me laugh hysterically. Yeah.
Was it not properly attached?
I don't know what they did. I was in the next bay and I was doing my own thing and I saw him shoot and the scope fall off and I just couldn't hold it back.
Everything I've read about the PSL, because I could never get the stupid thing to be accurate either, is they're not really meant for hyper accuracy. They're, like you said, it's a DMR and it's meant to give a squad a longer range engagement than a normal AK-47 or AK-74 would allow, which fills that role. So it did a job. It's just not a sniper rifle.
Yeah, I think DMR rifles in general are very misunderstood, like category of rifles.
It was a big awakening for everyone to realize that the American Sniper movie lied, because that guy, the enemy, was using a Dragunov, and that's not going to happen.
Yeah, the SVD isn't considered a sniper rifle either, I believe. I think it's another DMR.
That's correct.
Yeah, so I mean, I think that, I don't, maybe it's because in the US that hasn't really ever been a thing. Has it, Danny? I don't really know.
Recently, yes. Historically, I can't think of anything. I know somebody. I'm not that well versed in U.S. weapons history. I'm a little bit more like on the European side, but of like U.S. DMRs.
BDM 14. The M14 was made into a DMR rifle. They made it Enhanced Marksman Rifle, EMR, EBR, M39.
Yeah, they put the EBR stocks on it. That's more recent. I'm trying to think of something like maybe around World War II or something maybe before the 70s.
Yeah, but I think the issue is that the United States has always had a culture of the individual marksman versus having a guy in the squad be the marksman.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Yeah, I guess the U.S. typically wanted a rifle that could sort of be that DMR, you know, accuracy level, where maybe other countries didn't. Like, most of the countries were fine with fielding, you know, AKs and didn't necessarily train for that level of accuracy.
Well, and also, like, you have a conscript army versus a trained professional army as well.
Well, wasn't the AK developed? I swear I've heard the AK was developed from the submachine gun program, the PPS 48, 41, and 43, and the SVT was developed from the rifle program to go along with it.
Oh, so the extent of my knowledge on that is just from listening to Ian talking about it.
And mine too.
I can just kind of say what he said, which is that they had the whole family of submachine guns, and then they had their, you know, the rifles or Mosins and the SVTs. They developed the SKS, and the SKS was supposed to be sort of that rifle replacement to replace, you know, the Mosins and the SVTs. And then they're on the AK to replace all of their submachine guns, and they were going to have a sort of rifle and a submachine gun. Eventually, they realized that the AK can, you know, sort of do both roles just fine, so then you just have one gun. We were just talking about this recently, weren't we, Aaron?
I was messing with you, but yeah.
I can't tell sarcasm very well over text.
I know, that's why I like doing it. I was messing with Danny and telling him that the SKS was a stopgap, which it became a stopgap. It wasn't intended as a stopgap. So there's a difference between an intentional stopgap and one that just happened to become that because of a new design. The AK, though, you got to look, though, with regards the STG, obviously, out of this picture, the AK is such a radical change. I mean, it's obvious that's where people were going to start going, but to be the first one through the door and a mass adoption, it was a big, big risk.
Yeah, because the Sturmgewehr didn't get mass adopted.
No, and then we're not talking...
for lack of trying.
No, not yeah, for lack of trying, but like... To take and be like, yeah, this is going to be our main weapon. The Sturmgewehr did its role, but like it was, I don't know enough about them to know if that could have been a potential main rifle, if it was good enough, or if it needed to have improvements or simplifications. As I know from history, Germany tends to over-engineer shit.
Oh yeah.
And Danny's and Danny's videos on his the K-43, G-43.
Gun.
Yeah, then and the differences between those, or the what was it, the K-43? What were those, Dane? I can't remember.
But the K-43 and the G-43 are just the same gun. They just the Germans just had a nomenclature change. There's a lot of debate over that. The reason why they changed that, but my opinion on that is that it was mostly a sort of propaganda change. Gewehr had sort of an older negative connotation, like old guns were called Gewehrs. The new generation of the guns were all, carbiners. So they wanted to call it a G-43 instead of a G-43 just to make it sound newer and better. Actually, that's sort of my opinion.
The point I was trying to make was, what was the video you did on your semi-automatic, the SVT copies of the Germans? What's the semi-automatic German firearm from World War II?
There's two. There's the G-41, which is a bang system, gas trap. And then there's the K-43/G-43, which is the copy of the Soviet STG or right. SVT. I can't speak.
Yeah, sorry.
Gas system. That's the K and G-43.
Yeah, but didn't you do a video, Danny, saying the differences between something or other?
yeah, between the G41 and the G43.
Yes, you did do that. And mm-hmm. and like that mm-hmm. big thing, that I was the point I was trying to make, the long-winded point here, is that in your video you show where they made simplifications, where they were like started out crazy or a lot more complicated, and then made simplifications as they went down. And my long-winded point to get to this point is I don't know if that happened with the STG. If it had lived long enough, would it have been massively simplified, or if it was too overcomplicated to begin with? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't think there's enough experience with it in a mass fielded role for it to be considered. I know people are going to argue with me on this, but like,
yeah,
I still think that the AK is probably the first of a new generation.
Yeah. So the STGs did go through quite a bit of evolution during the war. They kind of started out as the MKB 42s.
Yep.
Then, you know, and then they sort of came out with the MP 43s, MP 44s / STG 44s. And then, you know, at the very end of the war, there's sort of the gun that people call the STG 45. There's, you know, quite a bit of changes and development going on. I don't know. It'd be neat to see if somebody could get their hands on like an MKB-42 and an MP-44 and look at the, you know, machining differences. But my sort of experience, like comparing German guns, like over that sort of mid-war period, that you tend to really see the shift between like 41 to 43. You really see this, where they just go, okay, like that pre-war high quality German like sentiment just kind of goes out the window. You know, they really, you know, start, you know, cutting corners that were just, you know, need to be done. So
yeah, I have an early war 41 and a late war 44 K98, and you can see the big difference between the two. Even the tooling marks are still on the receiver of the late war German Mauser.
Yeah, the tooling marks that are on the receiver, that are on top of the receiver ring on the K98Ks, those started to become much more apparent in 43. So that just kind of goes along with what I was saying. Like you could get like a 41 or a 42 made gun and then all of a sudden look at a 43 one and just notice a lot more machine marks of it. Mm-hmm. And the same thing goes along with, you know, with some of those guns, like from the G41 to the G43. There must have been some sort of program implemented at a higher level of saying like, look, skip, you know, cut corners everywhere, no longer care about aesthetics, you know, just focus on, you know, production, in certain production criteria. Maybe that had something to do with Albert Speer. I don't know when he took control, if that was around 43. I know Speer was able to turn it around where German production actually increased in 44, even though they were being bombed much, much more in 44 than in previous years.
Yeah, I remember learning that, not on the MILSERP necessarily, but tank production was higher, even though they were getting carpet bombed. They were making more assault guns like Stugs and Panzer IVs.
Yeah, very similar thing with most German industry at the time and all, you know, in MILSERPs in general. Yeah, you'll see a lot of 44 dated guns, much, much more than the early war guns. Though, weirdly enough, actually tried to lower K98K production earlier in the war because they thought the war was going to be over soon, so they didn't have to. They were going to lower production. Forgot what we started talking about, Aaron.
I don't know. It's why we just do this, right?
We're talking about AKs.
Oh man,
production.
This is a rambling video, man. Our rambling podcast we're doing here.
We went down a rabbit hole. That's for certain.
I think we started off talking about Lee Navies.
We did.
Oh, man.
And we ended up talking about World War II German production rates.
Yeah.
Circling back to the Lee Navies, are you going to shoot it?
I cannot answer that question.
If I do shoot it,
I'm not going to shoot, obviously, the original ammo.
Yeah.
Because I don't even think that would probably even fire. But if I do shoot it, it would probably be for Danny's channel.
Ooh, cool. I swear I've seen dies for that for sale.
Well, they were a popular sporting firearm for a while. They made quite a few sporting versions of it, actually.
Be a rimmed case, right?
No.
It's not.
It's super advanced for 1895. we were talking about this on the rifle episode. Danny, we're talking about the perfect rifle or whatever, Danny.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a super advanced 6mm, fast for the time, obviously, and a not rimmed case. And
I have a cartridge conversions of a handbook of cartridge conversions. I'll have to look that up and see what the parent case is. I'm kind of curious now.
Yeah, I'm not sure. The M block's actually kind of interesting too. We talked about. I mean, I don't know why this was never adopted by anything else. I don't know why this didn't go into anything else, but the M-block clip that Lee came up with was actually quite ingenious, whereas the Mannlicher clip for, like, the M95 is part of the... It needs to be in the gun for the gun to function because it serves as the feed lips. The M-block clip for the Lee Navy is basically just a stripper clip. You packet load a whole gun right then, and then when you chamber the first round, the clip falls out. And you don't need to have a clip to top off the gun. So you can single load the gun, or you can packet load a full clip at a time. So it's like an improved stripper clip almost. Danny? Have we lost Danny?
I think I lost it for a second. You guys were quiet for a second.
Did you hear what I said about the Lee?
Yeah, I heard most of it, I think.
So, like, I didn't realize that you didn't need the clip to make the gun function. So, like, I never understood. Then I was thinking about, like, why wasn't this in other guns?
Yeah, that's really smart. Does the clip fall out the bottom like a Mannlicher?
Yeah. So you still have the same issue if you have a hole down there. But, like, the idea that you could have the benefits of packet loading with an M-block clip and have the ability to top off like you could with a stripper clip. I don't understand why that wasn't in more featured in more guns.
That seems really interesting. I would definitely love to see that in action. That's really cool.
It's just a weird and the whole thing is weird. It's 6mm. It's like a tilting bolt, straight pull. It's like just this random. It's like a trials gun that should have never have gotten made. Like, the whole gun is weird.
I don't know much about the Lee Navy, and I'm just trying to, like, imagine it how you're describing, like, a clip that loads in. It doesn't need feed lips on the clip, and the clip drops after the first round. And I'm just trying to imagine how that's possible, and I have no idea.
So the clip, it looks just like a stripper clip. It looks just like a standard Mauser stripper clip, except it has a little bit of thing on the back for it to latch in. I don't know how the mechanisms work. I'm not an engineer. But, like, yeah, you just load the whole thing in the gun like you would a Mannlicher M-block clip, but the magazine itself doesn't need the clip for it to function. It just serves as a way to load it quickly.
Okay, so it's unidirectional?
Yes.
Okay. Makes more sense.
It's like the best of both worlds, Danny, and I don't understand why it never got...
But you still have a hole in the bottom of the
I agree, but Danny, that system was invented in 1895, and we had people, Bulgaria used M95s until World War II, and I don't understand if you're comfortable with the idea of having the hole in the gun. I mean, heck, France had Berthiers.
That's a good point.
Yeah, the Dutch had all their Mannlichers too.
Yeah, I was just thinking about the M1 rifle, you know, and it's got the big hole in the side of the receiver behind the charging handle.
I'm really curious to see how that works now. You've piqued my interest.
Yeah.
I don't know.
That's just one of those guns that just...
I don't know if there's any good videos on it, actually, how it works. I actually...
It's just one of those guns that's the cliche. It was ahead of its time. You know, it was too revolutionary. Who said that? I heard somebody that said this saying, like, you could have something that just is one step ahead, and people will pretty much accept it, you know, because it's just one sort of step ahead. It's one. But if it's like multiple things all together, then that's when people kind of start to get caught up and don't like it. It's just too many changes, even if they're all good changes that need to happen. So you have, you know, a nice, because I mean, when did the Lee Navy, US just skipped packet loading with the Krag? Completely until, you know, the 1903, it was ahead that way. I guess you could say there's, you know, maybe the Remington Lee was ahead of that in U.S. service because, you know, the whole spare magazine thing. But then it goes back to Lee again, I guess, at least.
Didn't the Norwegians have a stripper clip fed Krag, though?
Yeah, it was sort of a packet. It looked a lot like what the like K-31s, like the Schmidt Rubin charging packet. It looked a lot like that. Except it was like brass. It was like a solid brass thing. They had something like that. And I had been looking for some for my Norwegian Krag, and I could not find any.
If I also recall, the there was a bunch of stuff. I mean, obviously, the Army figured out that the Krag wasn't the most up-to-date rifle compared to other designs. So they tried to make it better. And I remember seeing something, somebody said something about, well, why didn't they make a stripper clip for it? Or why didn't they try to make 30-40 better? I was like, they tried, but it was like, we can't really make the round any hotter because the gun can't hold it. And at the same time, they were like, well, why don't we just design a new firearm, essentially? Because they did try to make 30-40 hotter, and I know that it did not succeed. And at the same time, they were also like, why don't we just make a new firearm and it'll be easier for us in the long run, because it's putting a Band-Aid on a knife wound.
Yeah. Well, they did make an improved 30-40, right? The 30-03.
I mean, yes.
30-03 was heavy bullet rimless.
He's making it as a joke.
Okay. I thought so. It went over my head a little bit, I guess. I'm pretty sure that's 30-06.
Yeah, he's making it as a joke that's because the United States, for some interesting reason throughout history, the United States has a huge fascination with 30 caliber.
And 45.
Yeah.
I remember hearing somewhere back that the 30-06 was like roughly based on an 8mm cartridge somewhere. It's obviously not, you know, 8mm, but they like took that overall design, it, you know, shrunk it down a little bit to 30 cal.
Well, you can make 8mm out of 30-06 cases.
Yeah.
I've done it. You can make a lot of, it's one of the parent cases of the world. There's like four, but you can actually make 8mm Mauser out of 30-06.
Yeah. I know you could do that. I was just trying to, I don't know if that's coincidence or by design, like if the U.S. just kind of straight up took a 8mm Mauser case and just made it a little bit longer, the 30 cal bullet in it.
They might have done
exactly what happened. I don't know.
They might have done it with 7mm because they fought 7mm in Cuba. And
oh, yeah, that would make more sense.
You can definitely make 30-06 into 7mm because I've done that too. I've made a lot of 30-06 or 270, they're amazing cases to make other ammunition with because they're long. So I would imagine it probably either came from that or didn't. Wasn't America in with the Swiss? They like the Swiss Schmidt Rubin style bullets, and I'm remembering from Matthias's episode. So,
oh yeah, well everybody took it was it wasn't Schmidt, it was just Rubin.
Yeah,
Rubin. Yeah, just his, you know, metal jacketed bullets. The U.S. funny enough, the U.S. did basically adopt is essentially the Swiss bayonet for the Krag. The U.S. Krag bayonet is very close to the Swiss Krag or the Swiss Schmidt Rubin bayonet.
I think that's what I was remembering. And then also the ability to have a magazine cut off, but you could top the magazine up like the 1889 Swiss, where it just pulls the mag down a little bit. They like that ability as well.
It's like it's one of the weirdest mag cutoffs, you know. There's no like mechanical block or anything that kind of goes up in the receiver like you'd expect. Just lowers the whole magazine out of the way. Mm-hmm. Really kind of interesting. Later on, when the Swiss got out of that, and they no longer wanted the mag cutoffs, they designed this little like piece of sheet metal snaps on to that little magazine. I don't know what to call that little magazine release lever thing, just so that you can't accidentally bump that up and hit the magazine cut off.
Now I'm trying to remember if mine has one or not.
Danny, I think I might have figured out why the Lee system didn't go into anything else.
All right, let's hear.
Well, I was just looking up the round, the 6mm Lee Navy. It was expensive as hell to produce. because it require it's not fully rimless, it's semi-rimless, and it required a beveled it was beveled as well. The big issue though is that the cartridge was basically designed to fit in the clips for the Lee Navy and could not be easily adapted into any other firearm. So like it's basically was made for this gun and we can't make it into a machine gun round because that would be a pain in the ass. And apparently, according to this, it was 3 times as expensive as 45-70 per round. There was also issues with the smokeless powder because it was the first smokeless round that the United States accepted. So there was a lot of issues with the smokeless powder being inconsistently charged and then also very corrosive. And I've heard that before, that supposedly that it was supposed to be that they were firing so fast that it wore out the barrels, but it was actually the fact that the primers and everything were so corrosive it just ate them.
Wow. The heck was in the... Was that... I mean, well, they're Navy guns. So, I mean, maybe just any salt in the primer is just an exacerbator for any, you know...
Yeah, it says right here that they showed signs of early barrel wear and throat erosion caused by inconsistent chamber pressures and powder burn rates, despite the Navy's requirements of nickel steel barrels. Yeah, so it got it. We come back to this again is where we talk about like a design or something being let down by the manufacturing of ammunition, like the Ross. You know, Danny.
Trying to think of another example.
I mean, the Ross is an example.
The Ross is a really good example.
There's something. The Ross is one, but I'm trying to bother me. Yeah, ammo. Yeah, the early ammo manufacturing definitely did kind of weird designs that existed only because of that ammo. And you know, today, as like a modern shooter, there's like a lot of maybe unnecessary safety features built into bolt actions that don't really need to be there. And in like a modern commercial made gun, safety features aren't there because this gun was designed, you know, in the 1800s when ammo was pretty shoddy. Those features are there.
Like the 1888 commission rifle. Is that what you were thinking of with the bursting barrels?
Oh,
Danny, you okay?
Yeah, I've gotten to that point of bourbon consumption where certain words are evading me.
It came to me as you were talking. I'm like, oh, I bet I know what gun he was thinking of. Sorry.
Wow, this has got an interesting excerpt from the official report about the investigation of the Lee Navy's round, because people were really skeptical of it, of being an effective round. So they said that it would not shock the enemy to put them out of action and would not sufficiently wound the enemy. And the report gave 3 responses. The battle of the future will be fought at long range, and men will not live to come close quarters with an enemy who stands his ground. 99% of wounded enemy soldiers were unlikely to investigate the severity of their wound and would simply retire to the rear. And the explosive effect of a small caliber, high velocity bullet against the human body, the bullet tumbles or fragments to produce devastating wounds against bone or fluid-filled organs, would be more incapacitating at all ranges than wounds made by a slow-moving bullet of a large caliber.
Wow, that's 18, very futuristic.
1894 right there.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah, looking at it with hindsight, it really is.
Yeah, but that makes sense why it was never really adopted in anything else, is because it requires a specialized cartridge, and that's just not going to work in a modern military. You can't just have a special round for something.
Yeah, it's crazy that there's still a ton of people today that put down small bore cartridges, you know, like the cliche, you know, boomer sayings of, you know, 5.56 not going to hurt anyone, so I need my battle rifles or whatever. And back in 1894, the U.S. government wrote a report. They're like, no, this is the future.
Yeah, and it's even a bit against a 45 caliber. It's 45-70 is what they were talking about.
Yeah. I need to look up the specs on 6mm Lee Navy.
According to this, the military loading was 112 grain bullet.
112, okay.
Was never updated for Spitzer, so it's still a torpedo.
Yeah, it was is too old. Do they give like a muzzle velocity?
2,560 feet per second.
Wow, that is hauling it.
It's pretty close to 6.5 Swedish.
With an energy of 1,629 pounds, or foot-pounds, sorry. Yeah, 2560 is the official military loading velocity. Yeah.
What year was 6mm Lee Navy, the ammo, designed?
1894 and 1895, according to this.
Okay. So that is after 6.5 Swede. I wonder if it was slightly influenced by 6.5 Krakano and then 6.5 Swede.
Be during the, what is it, like the 6.5 revolution where a bunch of countries were adopting it?
Yeah, in the 6.5 heyday. Their short-lived 6.5 heyday.
It says that noticing the trends of countries to adopt smaller and smaller calibers with higher velocities, U.S. naval authorities decided to leapfrog the trend by adopting a cartridge in 6mm. So it's like you said, Danny, you can make the one step, but if you make two, people are going to freak out. And it's what they did. They took a big leap, and it didn't work out for them.
Yeah.
I think it was a combination of they took a big leap, and the technology of the guns hadn't caught up yet. And the ammo itself, like we said. So like the guns couldn't hold up with the inconsistent ammo, and they also didn't have the consistent ammo either.
Yeah. Too many leaps forward, man.
This is written by the chief of the Bureau of Naval Ordnance in 1897. In making what may appear a radical departure in its selection of a caliber smaller than has yet existed elsewhere, the Bureau is convinced it is looking to the future. It is surely wise to attempt to advance with one stride as far as existing conditions allow toward the goal to which the world is moving with slow steps. It's like, we know this is where it's going, but so we're just going to go there and just let you guys catch up.
Wow. That's crazy. It'd be cool to see like a graph that showed U.S. bullet size diameter, you know, like over the years. It shoots way down from, you know, from 45-70 to 6mm and then slowly back up and then back down.
It's a 236 bullet diameter.
Oh, yeah, that's pretty small. And then to the who's in bullet territory there.
Well, I don't want to make this the Lee Navy podcast.
Oh, it's getting there.
I'm very much excited about it, and we will, I'm sure, discuss it more and potentially, when this is all over, when it's somewhat died down, Danny can come over and we can do a video on it.
Yeah.
That'd be sweet. I would definitely look forward to seeing that and learning a little more about it because I usually do more European, like Danny said. So it's neat learning about things that are from here as well.
All right. One last fact, Danny. You ready? I just saw this.
Hey.
And this is hilarious because you know how much I don't really care for Lee Enfields. The rifle powder for the new 6mm cartridge was Rifle Light, a flake nitrocellulose smokeless powder originally developed for use in the 303.
Wouldn't it be James Paris Lee that developed your Lee Navy, though?
Yes.
Same guy who developed the Lee Enfield?
He developed the magazine system.
Ah, okay, that's fair. Yeah.
But I don't know enough about it to say for sure if he developed any more part of it, but I'm pretty sure the Lee Enfield was more of him of the magazine system, and Enfield was more of the action, but I don't know for sure.
Well, the big difference between Lee Metford's and Lee Enfield's is the rifling.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to remember, because like a Martini Henry, it's one of the guys is the rifle and the other guy is the rifling. And then the Metford is Metford rifling. And then you can get a Lee, the long Lee Enfield, which is Enfield rifling. Didn't Joseph Speed update that action?
Oh, yeah. Mr. Speed. Yeah. I forgot what he did.
I just know that you can get long Metfords with Speed's patent on them because I've seen them for sale.
Hey, Lee sued Mannlicher, Danny.
Oh, boy. What did he sue him for?
The invention of an Inbot clip.
Oh, okay.
Who won?
Lee lost the case. It turns out that neither one could prove...
Simultaneous?
Yeah, neither one could prove that either one had known about each other before, so they had a simultaneous invention.
Yeah. Gosh. That time was just the heyday of that. It's like, it's the best time in firearms history, man. Like, 1880 to, like, 1900. it's so much, much stuff happened in just 20 years. Like you could just, person could devote their whole lives to just studying like 10 or 20 years of firearms development in just those years.
Yeah, I would, I think we've talked about this before. It's basically the equivalent of in 20 years going from like the Wright brothers flying to being in space. And we did that very fast anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a book about the Thousand Year Leap or the Great Leap Forward or something. It was like, yeah. And a person's living lifetime, they went from riding horses to being on the moon.
Oh yeah. That reminds me. I have a random fact for you. All right, Danny, that's a good point. You ready? Danny, are you there? Are you drunk yet? Or
I'm here. Nick, right around 9 o'clock, the internet gets worse here. That reminds me. What did you say before that? After that?
So, John Tyler, our 17th president, who was born in 1790, as of, I don't know if they're still alive right now, but as of last year, he had 2 living grandchildren.
That's crazy.
That's a very interesting fact.
And it's true. He had a child when he was like 70 something years old, and one of his that child had 2 kids when he was like 70 or 80 or something. So there's 2 living grandchildren of the 17th president of the United States.
I am just impressed that somebody conceived when they were that old. Kind of bad for the lady, though.
Yeah, they would have had to have had them too when you didn't have like hospitals where if there was a problem, you know, you were kind of just screwed.
Not just that, but some like young, fertile woman had to a 70-year-old. Because we really have digressed on this different, episode.
It's different times, man.
So, Milsart Market 2020.
Oh, yeah. Are we going to end this here? We are at about an hour and 20.
Oh, no. Well, we don't have to end. I was just going to say, any predictions for the future? Let's say, what do we think is going to happen for the next 6 months when it comes to the Milsart Market?
I think it's too hard to predict.
The only thing I would be comfortable saying is that the more people that come off of unemployment or reduced hours are going to be able to start buying things again. Myself included. Yeah.
And it's probably going to take a while. I bet people are going to have to catch up on bills and stuff like that. I know the passed in the whatever that CARE Act or whatever that was called. The way it's worded in there, the people that don't have to pay their mortgages that are sort of like defaulting on the payments, as soon as they have to give a 30 days heads up, they can't pay their mortgage. They just have to sort of keep doing that. As soon as they say like, okay, I have my job again, I can pay my mortgage this month, get hit with the full bill of all the past months. So if a person's rents like, or a person's mortgage is $1,000 a month, they miss 3 months payment. Then on that fourth month, they have a $4,000 bill due right now. So that kind of stuff, say on that fourth month, people are starting to work again and they get hit with that, you know, and these other bills on their credit cards and stuff like that. I think it'll be slow coming back is my point.
Yeah.
For a lot of people. For, you know,
and like I said, I think really Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Danny.
No, you go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I think, like I said, a lot of the casual collectors are going to be out of this. I think a lot of people are going to start selling stuff to be able to buy and afford more essential items. Anytime there's any kind of financial downturn, any kind of hardship, people start to shy away from hobbies or luxury items. And these are not necessarily considered essentials, I should say.
Yeah. And I bet a fairly large portion of like the firearms market is the casual, is sort of the casual buyer, but I think Milsurps are such like a niche sort of thing that most people that are into Milsurps, I think we're pretty passionate about this. And I'm not sure exactly how the market's going to flow, I guess, over the next 6 months. But I expect an overall buying lull. I guess increased supply as people sell off stuff, and an obvious decrease in demand for guns. So, just like I said before, you know, I'm selling a couple guns. You know, it's kind of like what Jared Billy said about it. It's guns that I don't necessarily care for that aren't the mainstays of my collection. That I'll just sell and get rid of.
I know personally too. I'm like watching like a hawk all of the things that are going on and chomping at the bit, so that way when I feel comfortable buying something again, I'm going to strike on it. And there might be some people doing the same thing where you may see a slow downturn and then a bunch of sales and then some more downturn as people are financially able to jump on the opportunity that they want.
Yeah. Did you see that the French Canadian K video? I think I just made it public today.
Yes, I did.
That gun, I think, was one of these deals where it should not have sold for that cheap on GunBroker. Like, I don't know why it didn't go any higher, but I think I was maybe the only bidder on it. I just won it for the minimum bid. Same thing with the Norwegian Krag. So,
I know on your recent podcast, you said that Makarov guys are the happiest collectors. I am a Makarov collector. I bought an East German Makarov for $300, which is like half.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah. That's about the only Makarov I actually want is an East German one. And I've come real close to buying them. I just never have done it.
Didn't Sam get one of those?
I think so. I think I saw him post something about it.
I think he does have an East German one, doesn't he? We'll have to ask him. Sam, the guy that's also, yeah, he's been on the podcast before. It's one of our mutual friends.
Mm-hmm.
Danny, we're gonna have to get going because I'm gonna have to go help put my daughter back down to sleep. She got up.
Okie dokie. Yep. All right. So I guess we could sum this up with, I don't think anybody knows what the heck is going on right now. This is the unprecedented times. We've all sort of made our guesses, but this is going to be the weirdest one. I think we're going to try to do one of these like Milsort market updates maybe every year or so. Might have to do two this year just because of it's going to be a real, real interesting year. Maybe we'll visit this again in 6 months and kind of see where we are and what we kind of predicted, see if that happened. But this was a pretty cool, cool episode. I actually enjoyed, you know, doing this and being able to digress as much as we want.
Yeah, I really appreciate being able to talk with people that actually like the same thing I do. It's kind of hard to find where I'm at, so I appreciate it a lot.
Yeah, there's not too many people like close by that necessarily here that enjoy Milsurps. We are kind of a rarity, and the main way we meet, I think we meet like other people that's into this is online. So that's one of the cool things I think that about Milsurp world and gas is it can kind of bring us together where we can talk about this when we, you know, normally wouldn't be on a Wednesday night. Okay. Thanks for coming on.
Oh yeah, Danny, do you want to say something here? You want to plug the Patreon?
Yeah, so thanks for coming on. Jared, he's one of our Patreon supporters. If you'd like to get on the podcast in the future, consider going over to patreon.com/milsurpworld. If you are one of the people that's affected by this pandemic and your financial situation is uncertain, don't put any undue, you know, financial pressure on yourself if you don't need to. You don't have to do that. As of right now, with Buzzsprout, the podcast it's sustainable, so that's okay. Don't feel pressure, but you can head over to the Milsurp World Facebook page and send me a message over there. I answer those pretty frequently.
All right. Well, Billy, I hope you had a good time.
Yeah, I did. I really enjoyed this. Thank you very much.
Hey, you're very welcome, man. Thanks for coming on. I appreciate it.
Yeah. I look forward to continuing to talk to you guys in the future if possible. And, you know, we might just strike up a conversation normally or something, you know?
Yeah, send me a message on Facebook anytime, man. I check that like all the time. Okay. It's easier to check than Patreon.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. So, yeah, I will do that.
All right. Good night, guys.
Yep. Thank you. Again, bye.